From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The memo has been released. House Republicans are alleging the FBI abused the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to spy on a Trump associate during and after the campaign. President Trump says a lot of people should be ashamed. The FBI says the memo makes material omissions a fact, and Democrats are afraid the president will use it as a pretext to interfere in the Russia investigation. Back on Tuesday, the president was talking about unity, but did his State of the Union address produce any? We'll discuss the president's pitch that we should unify around his existing agenda and his declaration that Americans are dreamers, too. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, January's jobs report was strong and showed the fastest wage growth since 2009. Is the economy in an uptick, and how much credit do President Trump and the new tax law deserve for that? All that, plus poll numbers that should worry Democrats, will be coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. As we tape on Friday afternoon, we've all just read the memo. This is the memo that was compiled by Republican Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, and it alleges that the FBI abused the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to spy on Trump associate Carter Page during and after the 2016 campaign. The memo has been heavily criticized by Democrats on Capitol Hill, who see it as a pretext for Trump to interfere in the Russia investigation, and also by the FBI, which says the memo contains material omissions of fact. To discuss this news, we're joined by Norm Ornstein, who's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and co-author of the book One Nation After Trump. So as I look at this memo, it looks to me like the core allegation is basically that the FBI relied on the infamous dossier as one, at least one of the pieces of evidence when it was seeking this warrant to surveil Carter Page, the Trump sometime foreign policy advisor. And the memo also claims that the FBI knew that the dossier had been funded by the Democratic National Committee, and they did not reveal that fact to the FISA court in the process of seeking the memo. I guess, Norm, what should we make of this as we read it and as we look at the political context in which it emerged?
Well, we can start, Josh, with the political context, which is we've never seen either the House or Senate Intelligence Committee operate this way. When they were crafted in the aftermath of the Church Committee investigations, the CIA and intelligence failures back in the 1970s, the whole point was that we were going to have nonpartisan or bipartisan efforts on the intelligence committees, and that we're going to see a trade-off with the intelligence community. They would give sensitive information to a small group of people who would keep it very close to their chests, and they would do vigorous oversight, but it was not going to be in the public eye. This kind of public partisan spat and the way in which it's been carried out, and in the aftermath, remember, of Devin Nunes already being slapped down and embarrassed, having gone to the White House with previous claims that proved to be false about unmasking involving Obama administration officials, information that he got directly from the White House. In that political context, it's already embarrassing before we see the content of it. Now, having seen the content of it and just what we know publicly, there's not much there. One, we know that the dossier was initially funded by the Free Beacon, which funded Fusion GPS, a firm looking into information about people, and they hired Chris Steele. But what we also know is that there was an investigation going on, counterintelligence investigation about Russian influence involving Mr. Papadopoulos even before Carter Page came up. And we know that the memo to the FISA court, which is 60-some pages long and contains a whole raft of information, goes way beyond the dossier, not to mention the fact that whoever funded the dossier and however it came out, there isn't much in there that has been challenged or disproven.
My understanding that Washington Free Beacon did engage with Fusion DPS for OPPO on Trump and then disengaged when he won the nomination and had nothing to do with Steele. And then Steele was brought on by Fusion when Hillary, the Democrats were paying for Fusion, just as a factual matter. So just a 30,000 feet point. You had Democrats nominate a political, a presidential nominee who was under FBI investigation. You had Republicans nominate a presidential nominee who got associated with people who are under FBI investigation. Those facts were going to create incredible stresses on the system, and both sides were going to be aggrieved for some reason or other. So I think that context is important for this entire discussion. There does seem to be some embarrassing information in this memo about the FBI that they didn't reveal to the court, supposedly the partisan sources of the dossier. Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI who's leaving, supposedly said that there wouldn't have been this FISA application on Carter Page absent the dossier. Comey, James Comey, is under oath saying that the dossier is unverified. But what we don't know is the FBI side of the story. So to fully evaluate what all this means, we need to hear more. And ideally, the way this process would have worked is in a more deliberate way, where the majority would look at the entire factual record, write a report. The minority would look at the factual record, write a report. They would be contrasting interpretations and takes, inevitably, just because this is a partisan matter now. And the public would get a chance to evaluate that record all at once. But that's not the world we live in.
I mean, the larger political framework here is the Trump administration's attempt to discredit the Russia investigation and make a case that political bias infected key action, right, in early stages of the investigation. I don't think this memo's release is going to be that big a play. I mean, Hannity will rail on tonight about how Rosenstein should be fired and Trump should
fire Mueller. That's Ron Rosenstein, the Deputy
Attorney General. I think both memos should have been made public at the same time. I mean, if you want to do partisanship, let's do hyper. The Democratic side of the Intelligence Committee and the Republican, maybe that wasn't possible. But to step back, I mean, will this undermine intelligence gathering efforts? Will this hurt national security, erode confidence in our institutions of government, which are already eroded? I don't know. But it's certainly designed, this memo's release, to create confusion, suspicion, deflection, doubt, and above all, noise. I think Mueller persists. This will be set aside from his investigation, and he is likely to find possible financial crimes and obstruction of justice.
Well, so the issue, and I'd like Norm's thought on this, is basically, you know, you could have released the Democratic and the Republican memos, but they're both making claims about an underlying factual record, much of which is classified, and much of which is probably classified for good reasons. I buy that this memo is not going to interfere with national security, but whatever evidence was in the application to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court may have relied on, you know, secret, you know, intelligence sources that we have in Russia or in other countries, and it may be impossible to disclose that information to the public in a way that does not damage U.S. abilities to gather intelligence. And so that leaves us in a position where sort of you're stuck between whether you trust Devin Nunes's account or whether you trust the FBI's account. And Norm, I think, you know, while I don't trust Devin Nunes about this, I think it's a heavy ask to ask people to basically just trust the FBI about what's in the secret record here.
Oh, I certainly agree that you don't want to take at face value claims that are made by the FBI or anybody else. They have to be judged. You know, you would hope that the intelligence committees operating in concert would do just that. I do think under the circumstances, it's really dicey here. The reasons why the Trump Justice Department and Trump's own FBI director, Christopher Wray, were really unhappy about the release of this memo. Some of them may well relate to the very sophisticated use of this stuff that goes beyond what you or I might be able to do by Russian intelligence sources and others to scope out some of the sources and some of the methods that we would have used. But at least under these circumstances, if this memo is going to be released, and it's a little troubling that Trump didn't redact any of it, given the requests made by the FBI, that we have the other side. And the other side comes from the FBI, and some of it may come from what is in the Democrats' memo, which may or may not ultimately be released.
Yeah, my position is radical transparency. So we've released this memo. And just as an amateur, it's really hard to see what would have damaged national security in this memo or appropriately been redacted. But let's see the Schiff memo. Let's, to the extent we can, see the intelligence on which all this is based. And it might require summarizing documents, might require a lot of redacting. But my whole interest in having everything investigated, having to do with 2016 from the beginning, was to get information. It wasn't to produce a black box special counsel, you know, trying to hunt down crimes. It was try to inform the public, and the more information, the better, in my view.
There's one piece of information in this memo that actually seems quite unfavorable to the president and his case that this was basically a made-up witch hunt, which is that it confirms something that we learned from the New York Times some months ago, that the core of the memo is about this dispute about a warrant that was sought in October of 2016 to surveil Carter Page. But the memo makes clear that the inquiry into people around the Trump campaign and their associations with Russia began at least as early as July of 2016 with George Papadopoulos, which would seem to undermine the idea that the surveillance of Carter Page was an important watershed moment, or that it was used as a pretext to create the investigation, because the investigation already existed before they got this warrant against Carter Page.
Yeah, from my conversations with people who are kind of plugged into this process, I thought there might be something in the memo referring to how the FISA application had some reference to Donald Trump himself, like he might be incidentally caught up in collection, which would have been bracing at the least and potentially explosive, but that's not there. So it does raise the question, why was the surveillance of Carter Page in particular so outrageous in the view of the committee Republicans?
Just again, 30,000 feet, Russiagate has to a large extent corrupted and corroded our politics. I mean, I watched on MSNBC, I think it was the other day, John Holman interviewing Senator Murphy of Connecticut. And there was a discussion about Devin Nunes, who I think, you know, is kind of off the reservation, if one can say that, but about John Holman asking Senator Murphy, do you think Devin Nunes could be a Russian agent?
That was crazy.
And I mean, but that's going on. I mean,
well, the Democrats didn't bite on it, at least.
There was not a robust rebuttal. And
he's I hope it's not true.
Yeah,
right?
I think you get into that, and we've seen through history the demonization of views of dissent and linking them to a foreign power. And it is at the height of that that this country's values get corroded. And I would say the other thing, and Norm referred to this, is, you know, I think we have to be careful about delegitimizing the FBI. We're witnessing an extraordinary moment, showdown between the FBI and the president. But skepticism is needed, because the FBI and many of these intelligence agencies have a history. I mean, James Clapper perjured himself twice before Congress, yet he sits on a CNN set today pontificating about the need for high intelligence to combat Russia.
And part of the background here is these committee Republicans had this wrestling match for a very long time to get information from the FBI that played into this memo. And again, as an amateur, it's really hard to see why the FBI would have been resisting that, except perhaps it would be embarrassing information.
Well, I think the memo is embarrassing, and then the exculpatory information for the FBI is information that is sensitive enough that it can't be released. So if something comes out about this, that they would say plausibly that it's incomplete information that will mislead the public rather than informing them, and that the FBI will be unable to defend itself because it would require damaging national security.
They have said that. But I think
they'll find a way to defend themselves.
Retort that it's going to damage national security has been used often. And I would add that there are stories in the media which have needed to be retracted because they have misled. And the Washington Post last year published a story which, if you read it closely, could well have broken open a source inside the Kremlin. And so does that violate national security? People applauded it at the time. Go back and find that.
I do think in this case, you know, I've talked to some people who know a lot about intelligence gathering and FISA. And the most plausible explanation for the reaction by both the Justice Department and the FBI, the very strong language about not releasing this, was just what you said, Josh, which is that this was a fairly extensive application to a FISA judge, and most of these FISA judges are anything but raging liberals trying to get Donald Trump. You know, you can be skeptical about the knee-jerk reactions of people in this field who want to do whatever they want to do, surveil anybody at any time. And we know the FISA process has, been at times, at least it appears, too loose. But this is getting into troubling territory, and the degree to which it has become so caught up in a combination of bitter tribal warfare between the parties, but also questions about what the future will bring.
We're going to take a break. Later in the show, Kelly Goff will join us to discuss the State of the Union address. But first, we'll be back with Norm Ornstein, Rich Lowry, and Katrina Vandenhoeven. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoeven of The Nation. And Norm Ornstein, co-author of One Nation Under Trump, is also with us. So, Norm, you've been writing for years about increasing dysfunction in Congress, the driver of many things, including what you've described in the breakdown of the House Intelligence Committee. Can you give us the thumbnail of basically what's gone wrong in Congress?
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, the single most important word is not polarization, but tribalism. You can have, as we have seen, really building over the last six decades, parties sorting themselves out into ideologically more coherent groupings. We don't have the broad tents that we had back when I first came to Washington. But you can have those great divisions ideologically and still find ways to make policy and work together. Emblematic of that was Orrin Hatch, who used to say, the very conservative chair of the Finance Committee now, who used to say that his proudest accomplishment in Congress was the children's health insurance program that he did with Ted Kennedy at the opposite end of the spectrum. But it's become tribal now. And that means in Washington, you view people on the other side of the aisle as the enemy. And it means out in the country that we're driven by negative partisanship, which means you're more concerned with blocking the enemy, trying to destroy our way of life, than with even embracing your own. When you have that kind of tribalism combined with the difficult problems that we face, the nature of the election process, and leaders who've exploited it, it makes it very hard to do anything constructive, and certainly to do anything with both parties. And I guess one other point I would make, Josh, is if we had a parliamentary system, parties operate that way. You have a party that has that's able to build a majority, and it makes actions, and the public, if it doesn't like them, can vote them out and bring in somebody else. But our political system wasn't designed around this. It was designed around compromise and finding broad leadership consensus. And we are so far away from that now. And it's even bled over into these very sensitive issues of foreign policy and national interest.
It's interesting. One person who actually seems concerned about this is the president. And one thing that he's talked about is that he thinks it was a mistake for Congress to get rid of earmarks, and that having a more explicit process where you can basically put little goodies for people into bills would make it easier to get people to work together again, that basically that was the grease that made the political process work.
Yeah, I think it probably helped grease the skid some, but at a cost of potential abuse, especially in the delay era when it just really grew out of control. I just think this is a process of running on for a very long time, and it's very hard to see how to reverse it, beginning with the ideological sorting among the two parties, because it used to be the Democrats had a very conservative wing in the South and the Republicans had a liberal wing in the Northeast or a moderate wing in the Northeast, and that's just not true anymore. And plus, you have added on the new media environment, the premium that's put on confrontation, never apologizing, ginning up your own base, and this is it's definitely stressed Congress as an institution.
But, you know, Norm, you wrote just at the end of last year, if in 2006 one could cast aspersions on both parties, over the past decades become clear that it's the Republican Party that has done unique, extensive, and possibly irreparable damage to the American political system. I'd like to hear briefly why you think that is, but let me just say I do think there's a case for a healthy partisanship. Partisanship got a bad rap. I mean, it's fast, you know, food fights on cable TV, but it's about standing for principles and values. And I do think we're seeing little outbursts of what I call transpartisanship in the Congress, where you have right and left working, for example, on restoring the War Powers Act or opposing mindless intervention. Walter Jones with a Ro Khanna. And I think you can see some outbreaks. But there's no question, Rich referenced the new media. I'd argue, and I know you've written about this, that it's not just new media, but it's the false equivalence embedded in media that has also contributed to the problems we're in.
I agree with all of those points. I do think that the polarization that we've seen has been more asymmetric, and that what used to be a conservative Republican central core that believed in a smaller, leaner, meaner government, but also believed that what we needed to work well, that really did believe that deficits and debt were bad and you needed the revenues to make that government operate, as well as putting restraints on spending, has been supplanted to a considerable degree by a more radical group of people who fundamentally don't believe much about government at all. You can see that reflected in Mick Mulvaney's budget and actually in Paul Ryan's previous budgets as well. You could see it back in 2003 when we had that famous almost 3 hour late at night vote in the House on the Medicare prescription drug bill that include building a repeal of Obamacare in the Senate with 15 Republican men in a room, even excluding the people most involved in the committees involved. Those, even though both parties are not clean, have tended to come on the Republican side. I'm not against partisanship. I don't think you can operate without parties and partisanship. But we're seeing the norms of governance shredded. And I must say, we do see some of those signs of bipartisanship. We've seen it with Richard Burr and Mark Warner, the leaders on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And it was kind of stunning that Devin Nunes wouldn't even share the memo with his counterpart, Republican, on the Senate side. And we saw it with the very commendable effort on a broad bipartisan immigration policy a couple of years ago that passed the Senate with almost 75 votes and then got no vote in the House. And then with this more recent effort with Dick Durbin, the Democrat, joining with Jeff Flake Lindsey Graham to try and come up with a compromise that had a lot of give on both sides that the president kind of blew up in his famous meeting where he talked about countries in an expletive.
I think can you just take up briefly for Republicans?
Sure. I think it's important to distinguish between limited government conservatism and shredding the norms in Washington. And I think a good example of that is Paul Ryan, who legitimately wants to reduce taxes, reduce entitlements, have very serious plans to do that. So would be an example, I think, of the kind of Republican that Norm is afraid of, but actually is a very polite man and respects the other side and honors these norms. And I think also it's important to point to the example of Barack Obama, when he lost Congress in 2010, he didn't moderate at all. He decided basically to govern unilaterally and in many cases to de facto write legislation on our own. And I think it's not a complete picture if you neglect how corrosive that was and the reaction it understandably created among the GOP.
We're going to have to leave this there. Norm Ornstein, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Josh. My pleasure.
While the end of the week was heavily focused on the memo, which sharply divides these parties and exacerbates these tensions, the White House was saying ahead of the president's State of the Union speech on Tuesday that he intended to make a pitch for unity. And in the speech, he said this.
Over the last year, the world has seen what we always knew, that no people on earth are so fearless or daring or determined as Americans. If there is a mountain, we climb it. If there's a frontier, we cross it. If there's a challenge, we tame it. If there's an opportunity, we seize it. So let's begin tonight by recognizing that the state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
I want to bring in Kelly Goff, columnist for the Daily Beast. Welcome, Kelly.
Good to be here.
So was this a unifying speech or was it a dividing one?
Absolutely unifying, as long as you are not a racial minority, an immigrant, or anyone else for whom the country is not just humming along perfectly. I think it was a good speech, Josh. I think it was a real missed opportunity, though. I don't know how you could give a speech like this reflecting on the year that was 2017 and not even utter the word Charlottesville. I think had he done that, it would have been a great opportunity to press reset for some of his critics. And I think the fact that he did not do that when he was listing all of the tragedies that affected our country this past year, it wasn't just a missed opportunity, but it really prevented the speech from being what it could have been. And I think it's going to prevent his presidency from being what it could be, as low as the expectations might be.
I think that's a fair point. Look, I think it was a good speech. I think his best aspect of him is a booster, and he is kind of a natural optimist. That's why he exaggerates everything about himself. It's just he everything's
including the audience for the speech.
Of course, yeah, that's our president. But I thought it was a good speech. I think it hit unifying notes that were appropriate. I'm not a huge fan of recognizing people from the balcony, but as part of the State of the Union tradition, and one that he really took to a new level, I think, because Trump, you know, he needs to be warmed up and softened. And the best way to do that rhetorically is to point to people who have very moving stories in the balcony. But the problem is with his unifying message is it's not credible to a lot of people, given the way he behaves otherwise. And I think it'd be very powerful, going to Kelly's point, and might be something that he'll be driven to by political necessity sometime prior to his reelection, just at some point to say, our politics is really divisive. I wish we were more unified, and I regret the role I've played in making us more divided.
Can I just say really quickly that Richmond reelection campaign?
About, I think it was last July at a rally in Youngstown, Trump said, it's easy to act presidential. It's not going to get things done. I think he spoke both, first, certainly for the first 15 minutes as a unifier, and then moved quickly into being a divider. You could say what a difference a year makes. This was not American carnage. This was no mountain high enough. American moment, seize the moment. He is a salesman, which means you rarely let details get in the way of a good story. I do think that the Reagan-esque invite the guests has reached a new low. I thought on the immigration front, putting aside what I think, you know, the political ramifications of his nativist language he used in 2016 and during his first year, but most Americans say immigrants strengthen the country. I thought by inviting parents of children murdered by MS-13 gangs, there was a sheer cynical exploitation of their losses by conflating MS-13 with dreamers. Trump was using the murders of innocent kids as an excuse to deport more completely innocent kids, and I thought that was pretty sinister. And, you know, was criminalizing immigrants, scapegoating immigrants, and obscuring the fact, by the way, that the foreign policy and military interventions of the United States created MS-13 in the first place during Reagan's dirty wars.
I actually thought that was one of his stronger. What I was going to actually say is
disagreement.
But my surprise was actually how diverse some of the people in attendance for the State of the Union, including the two Latino families of the two girls killed by MS-13, as well as the border agent, C.J. Martinez. And I think what I actually have to say is my read of that was a bit different, Katrina. I think what it spoke to is the diversity of viewpoints on the failures and successes of U.S. immigration policy, not including within the Latino community. I mean, I think that what he spoke to, there was a great CBS report even during the campaign that found how many people in border cities in Texas, my home state, were actually secretly supporting him because they were saying that, you know, it's really easy for a white progressive living in a major city to say, you know, we should have an open border policy. They're not the ones whose kids are getting murdered here on the border because of drug deals. And so I actually thought that spoke to some of his policy successes because whether people want to admit it or not, actually his immigration policy so far seem to work in terms of keeping some of the people out who do not represent the best of immigrants in this country.
You know, I respect your point, Kelly. On the other hand, I do think there was a keen effort to criminalize immigrants and to scapegoat them through this. And I
don't think it's a bad thing to say that not all immigrants are good for this country.
Yeah, but this
and
was
I think
a broader
that the left has
gestural
a problem
symbolic
with acknowledging that.
But look, by the way, the immigration policy Trump is wielding at the moment. Listen, Obama was deporting
more people,
criminals. But I'm saying the policies right now are cutting a much wider swath, and the danger of criminalizing immigrants allows one then to move into
demonizing. Not all immigrants, but those who are criminals should be called out. And I think him saying he wants a pathway for citizenship to dreamers was actually a success of his speech. And I think when the left downs the things that are actually successful, the policy things that are working, they alienate the people they have an opportunity with. There's a poll that's out this week that shows that in my home state of Texas, he only has a 39% approval rating, which means there's a potential pickup a la Doug Jones in Alabama.
Absolutely.
But only if I think they talk more honestly about the things and
talking
policies
honestly,
that are working.
But I didn't think this was honest. I thought this was cynical and exploitative.
I thought there was a bunch of this sort of Rorschach test stuff in the speech that I think actually is very dangerous for Democrats. Because there are a number of, you know, the president talked about the dangers of MS-13, and we can argue about how important a threat MS-13 is, but it is a bad and dangerous gang that kills people. And so if you criticize the president for criticizing a bad criminal gang, it's kind of weird. Like, what's wrong with that? The president says Americans are dreamers too when he's talking about the need for U.S. immigration policy to serve the interests of U.S. citizens, and people view that as a dog whistle and sort of trying to cheapen the position of the dreamers. But when you look at the statement itself, it seems unambiguous. Americans are dreamers too. And so it seems like he put a bunch of stuff out there that is going to draw criticism from Democrats that is likely to seem perfectly reasonable to voters in the middle who don't necessarily endorse the president's whole agenda on immigration, who find him divisive in other places. These are things that he said that I think were unified in the sense that they appeal to more than 50% of the electorate.
Right.
And he's able to bait Democrats into attacking him over them rather than fighting on a lot of the ground where he usually fights, where he's only appealing to 37%.
Right. The percentage of people who would be offended by the line, America are dreamers too, is extremely small and very overrepresented on MSNBC.
I'm offended by the conflation of MS-13 gang members with dreamers. Forgive me, Rich.
Okay, so on MS-13, it's a horrific criminal gang that does not prey on white middle-class people. Those two couples in the balcony whose children were killed by these thugs were not white middle-class people. They're from immigrant working-class community in Long Island. This gang should be crushed. And the idea that he was conflating those gang members with dreamers at the same time he was saying 1.8 million dreamers should get a path to citizenship just makes no sense.
I will say the thing that disturbed me at the end of the speech, and presidents always sort of put the foreign policy at the end, it was all about adversaries and enemies. There wasn't a sense of allies, of America having allies in the world. And there was a sense that we were besieged and our defense budget was too low. Give me a break. It's at historic highs and it's rife with waste and abuse. So I think in that context, it was calling out North Korea in the way he did. It was interesting that the news reports suggest pretty hardline policy person on Korea, Victor Cha, has refused to be the ambassador because of real concern about preemptive dangerous action by the Trump administration.
Who would want that job? And I will say
Jimmy Carter.
I thought they decided not to nominate Victor Cha, not that he withdrew. Go ahead, Kelly.
Well, I was going to say, and two more quick observations is I didn't see this, but my mother, who's a very reliable news source, did, and she said at one of the viewing parties that was aired, people actually laughed at the lines where he talked about us having lots of friends in different countries, us being unifying, our country coming together, that there was actually like belly laughs coming from audiences. The other quick thing I wanted to mention, too, that I haven't heard commented on as much is there's been a lot made of Melania Trump not standing and applauding during his talk about family unity. We all know some of the stories going on allegedly about their marriage at the moment. What I actually found more interesting is how he opened the speech. I went back and took a look, and I couldn't find where President Obama had ever acknowledged the First Lady of the United States. Apparently, that's not a common thing to do. But if you notice, he opened the speech by saying, Mr. Speaker, members of Congress, the First Lady of the United States. I thought that was just sort of an interesting thing in terms of delivery that might sort of be telling us a little bit, too.
I think one broad point that has to be encouraging for the White House, a lot of the instant polls on the State of the Union were really showed almost universal assent. Like half of Democrats in one poll, maybe it was a CBS poll, said they like it. And it just shows to me he has not been completely tuned out yet. And if he did a few things differently, the path to 47% would be there for him.
But can I just say, though, the CNN poll— Sorry, but the CNN poll actually though said it was the lowest rated. What was it since they'd been keeping the poll in like 20 years or something, though?
Yeah, it's, these polls are people who watch the speech. Yeah. Mostly people who watch the speech like the president already, even Democrats watching the speech. So I wanted to – but the thing Rich said basically about sort of, you know, not being tuned out, trying to turn the page, this is sort of the history of Trump's whole career, which is that basically he'll have vicious, nasty fights with people and call them horrible names, and then circumstances will change and he'll decide tomorrow that he's your friend. And so I guess going back to how we opened this conversation with Kelly, you were saying that basically he needed to say something about all the bad things he had said before. And I think Trump's wager is he didn't need to say that to Omarosa. He didn't need to say that to Steve Wynn. All of these people like that he was able to make up with, and that he thinks he can do that with Black Americans at large and with all sorts of other segments of the electorate that didn't support him before. And I guess, you know, it seems like he ought not to be able to do that, but there are all sorts of previous times in his career where it seems like he ought not to have been able to achieve that, and yet he did.
But let me say this is, I was rereading the other evening the interview that Heather Heyer's mother gave to the Daily Beast. Mm. And when she was speaking about how they had played phone tag immediately after her daughter's death. And the White House just hadn't been able to reach her, and she planned to take a call from him. And then when he talked about equating both sides having responsibility in the moments that led to her death, she said, "I'm done. I will not take a call from a man who says that." So you're right. You know, calling a celebrity foe on reality TV a bad name, I think, is something he equates to referring to people from certain countries as a derogatory name, from insinuating that certain Latinos and Black Americans are criminals. I don't think he realizes that. I think he'll get a wake-up call when the polling comes in as he's attempting to run for re-election.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast. I've been talking with Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Jim Tankersley from The New York Times to talk about some good economic news and how much credit the president deserves for it. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On Friday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its monthly jobs report, and the initial estimate shows the American economy added 200,000 jobs in January, meaning we've experienced 88 consecutive months of job growth. More interestingly, the report showed wages rising at an annual rate of 2.9%, which is the fastest rate of wage growth since 2009. The president has been taking credit for the strong economy and for corporate announcements of wage increases and bonuses, attributing economic performance to his policies on taxes and regulation. Joining us to discuss that is Jim Tankersley, who covers economics for The New York Times. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into who deserves credit, can we talk about how much the economy has actually changed during Trump's presidency? There's been a tendency to talk about the past year's growth as an extension of growth under President Obama, and the pace of job growth has been pretty steady for 7 years. But this wage growth number looks like it might be something new, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have seen actually a slight slowing from the in the job creation numbers from the last few years of the Obama presidency, although that would be to be expected given where we are with the unemployment rate and getting closer to full employment, if not there already. But yeah, the wages are starting maybe to look like their rate of change is going up. Now, this is a one-month number. Before then, it looked kind of flat or maybe even a little down from the growth of Obama's last year. But this number is very good on wages, and it might give us some hope that finally we're starting to see that pickup that economists have long predicted on wage growth.
And so does this have something to do with the tax bill when you see these bonus announcements? Can the president credibly say that this wage growth is being driven by his policies?
It's really hard for me to think that that would be the case right now. There's certainly a case that the president can start making maybe soon that companies are passing on the savings to their workers or making the sort of investments that result in higher productivity, which lead to higher wages. But for all the the talk we've heard and all the big headlines about bonuses being handed out, there just frankly aren't enough of them to make a big difference in these underlying numbers. On the other hand, we did have a lot of minimum wage increases across states in January that happened, and that might have had a small but important effect here in that number. So there is some policy happening here, but I think from the president's point of view, it's very difficult for me to believe that those bonus announcements and wage increase announcements over the last month are what we are seeing driving this uptick right now.
Rich, this has been a key part of the president's messaging, including in the State of the Union. Basically, America is open for business, and because of what I did, this stuff is improving. And we've seen the poll numbers for the tax bill. They've improved. The bill was very unpopular. Yep. It's maybe now not so unpopular.
Yeah, I think there was a Monmouth poll that had it break even, which is not, you know, a great place to be, but it's better than being 20 points underwater. And it seems to me that people, one, are realizing that actually, despite some of the advertising, their taxes are not going to go up under this bill. And two, there's been a cascade of good news associated with it, a lot of it having to do with one-time bonuses that weren't really the purpose of this tax cut and shouldn't be the purpose of our tax policy. But it's certainly a pro-business policy, and we are seeing that ripple through the business community in ways that I think even businesses themselves aren't fully sure of what the effect will be. They're still working through it, but we are seeing businesses talking about investing more in the United States, and that was one of the main selling points.
Yeah, I mean, this tax bill in many ways was a big wet kiss to the richest and corporations. As Jim was saying, I mean, wage growth actually slowed during the first year of Trump's presidency compared with the last year of Obama's. Labor market was strengthening long before Trump elected or the tax bill passed. And I think, you know, some big companies, Trump is a cheerleader. Obama was not. Obama was all caveats and careful not to seem out of touch with so many people in this country who are doing well. But I mean, big companies to butter up Trump are talking up modest pay raises for workers. But most gains, and I'd be interested in Jim's thoughts on this, are going to go to executives and investors. Most of the gains are going to go to shareholders in forms of dividends, stock buybacks, and higher share prices. And the bigger point is this may well, the tax bill, loot the ability to invest in our future. Trump talked up infrastructure, right? Jobs. But I mean, it's tough to do workforce development. It's tough to do adequate vocational training. It's tough to do the kind of real infrastructure without investment. And the tax bill may well deprive this nation of the investment needed for that.
Jim, how do we figure out who's getting what share of the benefits? Are workers really just getting the crumbs, like Nancy Pelosi says, or are they really getting a large share of the benefit from this tax cut?
I'm going to give you a very unsatisfying answer, which is that we all need to be kind of patient to figure out exactly how this is being divvied up. On the one hand, I think it's pretty clear from reading a whole bunch of earnings reports and forecasts the last few weeks that companies are doing more in terms of share buybacks and dividends than they are in terms of announcing raises or even announcing new capital expenditures. But that's sort of what you'd expect in the first wave after a big profit-taking tax cut that we're seeing. And so now what we're going to have to watch is a bunch of indicators in real-time data in markets over the next year, and then a bunch of good studies trying to disentangle all this in the years after that. And that will help us to understand, hey, how much of this cut actually yielded the sort of investment that boosts the economy and does lift wages because of productivity. And I think that's the it's a nerdy thing to talk about, but the productivity numbers are still pretty bad. And that is a thing that if we want to see sustained wage growth that we can maybe attribute to the tax bill, an uptick in productivity would be a great place to start looking for it.
Jim just said something interesting. We don't know yet. And what we do know is, I mean, come on, presidents take the blame or the credit. But in this case, these factors, these fundamentals have been in play for a number of years.
This is what presidents always do. They always take undue credit for good economic news. Bill Clinton famously did it, even though the recession was over before he was elected in 1992. And then you come in and the business cycle is in a good place and you say, I did it. And my policies that have actually, you know, been passed several months into my administration won't have an effect for another year or two. They're all responsible.
But let me ask you a question, Rich. One thing that's been interesting about watching the numbers, the tracking of Trump and the economy, because Trump is such an outsized, volatile, to be kind, personality, he doesn't seem to be getting as much credit as he should. And that may be a factor, because if he's been, quote, acting presidential, trigger him into some other things. These are factors which could weigh him down, and you could see a delinking, which is more traditional, as you said, of a president taking credit and getting credit.
Yeah,
he may not get the credit.
I was worried about that for his sake the end of last year. Now I'm beginning to think maybe it isn't as delinked as I might have worried.
Jim, one thing that the president has been taking credit for is record low black unemployment. And now this January report actually showed a slightly higher black or a substantially higher black unemployment number than we saw in December. Because it's a subsample, you shouldn't read too much into those month-to-month moves. But the overall message that unemployment is low for Americans as a whole and also low for black Americans right now is a true one. What do you make of as the driver of that? And does the president have anything to do with that?
Well, first off, I think that this White House is uncharacteristically compared to past White Houses, embracing kind of daily or monthly fluctuations in numbers. And this is something that I think is absolutely what we have historically seen when the labor market starts to get tight. What happens is, unfortunately for African Americans, they tend to be the first hit by bad economic times and the last helped by good economic times in the data. And so what's happening here is because the labor market is healing so much, it's pulling down their unemployment rate too, which is great news. And I think overall, the president can take credit for it such that he is overseeing a tight labor market. And if he's going to be taking credit for all the other things in a tight labor market, he gets, you know, to take credit for that too.
But so this actually sort of hits back onto a theme that we saw in the State of the Union, which is basically trying to paint himself as the president for all Americans. Look at these big picture things and don't maybe worry so much about the specific thing that I did that bothered you. I mean, the president has had a track record of sort of fomenting these racially charged controversies about NFL players and whatnot. And the pitch here sort of seems to be, well, the economy is good for Americans of all races and therefore Americans of all races should like me. I don't know whether that's going to fly.
I mean, it would help just from cynical political purposes to have some, whatever it is, some program at least symbolically geared towards black employment levels. So it could point to that. But it's, as Jim points out, it's a statistical artifact of a growing economy. Any president is going to take credit for that. But the idea that this is going to soften his image considerably among African Americans is highly unlikely.
Listen, this tax bill is also going to hurt access to health care, access to secure retirement. Working families will suffer if earned income tax credit is cut. And I think, he touted also vocational training and workforce development. As I said earlier, it's what's going to happen, it looks like, particularly with Trump's call in the State of the Union for busting the defense sequester caps, is you may well see a Republican Party not as tied into being the cheerleader for the economy, turn around and begin talking about cuts to programs that really do impact African Americans, working families, working people. And there's a clear sense, which again I come back to, and I think the Democrats can do the job of really showing how this tax bill is working against working families. It is not a fair share tax bill. It's privileging those already privileged. And I don't think you're going to see as many bonus scams. I mean, I'm all for the bonuses, and I personally think Nancy Pelosi and the crumbs is not the right thing to say, because for millions of Americans, a little tick up in their wages and their monthly pay is good.
$1,000 is a lot of money.
It's good. No, a lot of people. I respect that. But at the same time, I think you've seen this kind of bounty of bonuses, and that may step back. And I think that's partly because these companies wanted to show how they valued the tax cut, the tax bill.
Jim Tankersley of the New York Times, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Still with me are on the left Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine and Rich Lowry of National Review. I want to talk a little about the polls. Polling for Republicans has materially improved in the last month. The president is up to 40% approval in the 538 polling average, which is not a great number in general, but it's the best he's done since May of last year. And while Democrats are still leading in poll questions about how people intend to vote in congressional elections later this year, they're not leading by as much as they were. The average of polls has Democrats ahead by a bit over 5 points. And for most of the last 6 months or so, it's been an 8 or a 9 point lead. Katrina, why do you think this is tightening?
I think you're coming off the State of the Union. You're coming off of what we were talking about, the tax bill. It's being sold, I think, not in an honest way, but it's being sold as working for working people. I do think it's too early, Josh. I think it's too early to tell. Charlie Cook, who does a lot on the polls around the House and the Senate, he had an expression, it's the wave versus the map, right? I mean, you're looking, will it be a broader national environment beginning to break so sharply against Trump and Republicans? Even the Senate could be in play, or is it going to be the map, which is less, it's not as tough a map for the House. It's a tough map for the Senate. Democrats need a strong, clear counter message. And the more they fixate on the Russia investigation and less on jobs, infrastructure, and speaking to people's conditions and improving their lives, I think the more trouble they're in.
Rich, it's this kind of funny situation we're in where we keep seeing all these Republican retirements from the House of Representatives continuing unabated, even as the polling is starting to look somewhat less dire right. for those Republicans who might seek re-election.
Right. Well, in any circumstance, it's not going to be a good midterm for them. And some of these folks retiring are committee chairmen who are getting term limited out of their positions. But I think a couple things are going on. One, Republicans passed the tax bill. So prior to that, Donald Trump had seemed this guy who acts completely unpresidentially and is inept and can't get anything done. Well, he finally actually got something done. It made Republicans feel better, and the news around it has been pretty good. Plus, just there's this disconnect where we have this poisonous froth of our political debate atop a country that actually is doing pretty well. I mean, we have peace and prosperity, and what Republicans have to hope is those conditions overwhelm the things that people find disconcerting or even worse about Donald Trump.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Katrina VandenHeuvel, what's your rant?
Robert Perry's death last week leaves a giant hole in American journalism. He was one of the best, most independent-minded American reporters of the past 50 years. Refused to take on faith the official story, won Polk Awards, other awards for that. He launched a unique journalistic space, consortiumnews.com, where for 22 years he oversaw the website, winning a Harvard Nieman Award for it. He was notably non-ideological. What propelled him was a moral core and determination to follow the facts. No one knew better than Bob Perry how intelligence agencies and major media outlets can create a cascading frenzy. He was prolific as he debunked the torrent of hyperbolic claims about Russia across the U.S. media landscape, and he stood for the values of journalistic principles of skepticism and even-handedness. Carried the lantern high, now others will need to carry it on.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
It's not news that we have a fevered political debate in this country, but yet another indication of that was the freakout over a remark made by Paul Ryan. This week, he was accused of proto-totalitarianism for saying the FBI should be quote-unquote cleansed. When you actually look at the context of what he was saying, though, he was saying all the information about the FBI should be released. So no, Paul Ryan is not a latter-day Stalinist.
That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina VandenHeuvel, Jim Tankersley, Kelly Goff, and Norm Ornstein. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music, and I am Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.